From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is the debut of Fresh Air's new theme music. It's composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. On today's Fresh Air, a concert with the composer of our new theme. Marlon Brando did a comic turn on his character of the Godfather in last year's movie The Freshman, which has just come out on home video. Coming up, a talk with his co-star, Bruno Kirby. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Wynton Marsalis' latest album. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews the return of Dark Shadows. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The two sides in today's talks in Geneva appear to have been talking past one another. Secretary of State James Baker insisted on Iraq's withdrawal from Kuwait, while Iraqi Foreign Minister Tariq Aziz persisted in linking talks with the Palestinian question. In Washington today, President Bush refused again to allow the issues to be connected.
We oppose linkage, the coalition opposes linkage, and the argument with Saddam Hussein is about Kuwait. It is about the invasion of Kuwait, the liquidation of a member of the United Nations, a member of the Arab League. And it has long been determined by not just the Security Council, but by the entire United Nations that this is about Kuwait.
Tariq Aziz told reporters today that Iraq would definitely attack Israel if war breaks out in the Persian Gulf. He complained that the U.S. has ignored Israeli aggression and the occupation of Palestinian territory.
When it comes to Israel, you are calm, you are not worried, you can wait for months and years to try to persuade. If they are not persuaded and if they continue the positions, you don't do anything, you continue your support. But when it comes to the Arabs, there you raise the stick.
President Bush told reporters that he hasn't given up on a peaceful outcome, but said the choice was up to Saddam Hussein. French President François Mitterrand said today that Iraq could still avoid war in the Persian Gulf if it announces a withdrawal from Kuwait before next week's UN deadline. Mitterrand suggested that an Iraqi withdrawal could be supervised by UN Secretary General Javier Pérez de Cuellar with support from Arab countries. The French president said he spoke by telephone today with President Bush. Mitterrand said that conversation led him to believe that war could still be averted if the start of an Iraqi withdrawal was announced and executed before January 15th. President Bush has issued an executive order giving the government authority to receive priority in the delivery of any material or resources deemed necessary for war. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The executive order was issued while Secretary Baker was still engaged in talks with Iraqi Foreign Minister Tariq Aziz. The order delegates authority to cabinet secretaries to receive priority in the delivery of all food resources, forms of energy, construction materials with respect to civil transportation, and any and all other articles and materials. The order says this authority will not be used until Defense Secretary Dick Cheney determines that prompt delivery is in the interest of national security. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the White House.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 39 points today to close at 2470.3. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Fresh Air has new theme music, and today we have a concert with the pianist who composed it. He's Joel Forrester, co-founder of the group The Microscopic Septet, which performs the theme. If you're a regular Fresh Air listener, then you're already familiar with some of their music. We love the Micros and play their records a lot on the show, like this composition by Joel, Lobster in the Limelight. Here's another one of Joel's, played by the Micros, Off Color. Both of those pieces are included on the Microscopic Septet album, Beauty Based on Science. And in case you missed the new Fresh Air theme, here it is, written by Joel Forrester, performed by the Micros. Well, there it is, our new theme, and with nobody talking over it. Since we're premiering the theme today, we thought it would be a good time to listen back to a concert we recorded with Joel Forrester in May of 1990. Joel Forrester, welcome to Fresh Air.
Oh, gee, Terry. Let me just say from the jump that it's a gas to play live here on Fresh Air.
Why don't you get us started with a tune?
Well, yes, I'd like to start with a tune called Stop the Music.
Great. That's Joel Forrester at the piano. Joel, I've heard you play with the Micros and heard your records and stuff, and I think a lot of your playing and composing, you know, really combines elements of early jazz and elements of the avant-garde. How did you start doing that? How did those two come together for you?
Well, I think they just sort of appeared before my ears, but so many different kinds of music have meant the world to me, mm-hmm. that eventually that became the world, I would say. And I didn't think I could scant one, you know, and emphasize another. Just so many different forms of jazz just seemed to have announced themselves to me to be ready to be played. I couldn't imagine really playing without boogie-woogie, playing without bebop, playing without New Orleans music from the turn of the century.
Was it hard for you to find people to play with?
Eventually, in New York, people came around. But I think that the unifying factor among us was love for Thelonious Monk and the whole weird tradition in jazz.
The weird tradition in
jazz. That's right. We found that wherever we were coming from, the lightning rod of Monk's music allowed us to have a suspicion that we might be able to make music together.
Can you play something for us that will give us a sense of the weird strain? Is that the way you put it?
Oh, I guess I can try. Actually, to tell you the truth, this tune has it's really encumbered with history.
Uh-huh.
It's a tune called Dr. Real. Dr. Real is the name of a character in a novel I wrote about 20 years ago called The Real Life of Richard Nixon. He tempted Nixon to a sort of Faustian bargain. Dr. Real was a name that I assumed when I got out of the clink for draft resistance. When I wanted to play, and I wanted to play under an assumed name. And many of those gigs were gigs playing behind silent film. And I did that in San Francisco for a fat year under the name Dr. Real. And this is the tune that came out of that experience.
¶¶
It's wonderful. That's Joel Forrester at the piano. It's wonderful the way you create this really infectious rhythm and then occasionally completely subvert it.
I have no choice in the matter, Terry. Something else, something overwhelming occurs, and I have to go with it if I want to stay in the groove.
When you came up with the name Dr. Real, it was after you were a draft resister, spent some time in prison. What was it like to be in prison and not have a piano to play? How long were you in prison?
Oh, just a few months. It wasn't long. I drew a 3-year sentence. Everyone gets out quite early.
Mm-hmm.
There was a piano, but it was reserved for Sunday church services. And I remember it being played in a very four-square, rhomboid fashion by a member of the Gideon Bible Society, who was sort of on loan serving the lumpen, you know, déclassé. And I petitioned the warden time out of mind, you know, to allow me to play, and he always copped to the liberal democratic riff that if I were allowed to play, then all the prisoners would be allowed to play piano. And can't you picture it, Terry, these thousands of pianists lining up to take each his one moment at the keys.
You were telling me that when you were around 15 and started playing your first gig.
That's right.
That you lied to your parents about who you were playing with.
My mother, who's listening to this in Pittsburgh, the day after my birthday, Mother, I'm sorry. Yes, I did lie to you when I was 15. I told you that those guys with whom I was playing at the Panther Room, you know, by the Liberty Tubes, I said they were college men. They weren't, Mother. They were just these rummies from around Pittsburgh who are probably still doing gigs at the Panther Room today.
What influence did they have on you?
Oh, I think they brought out and tempered my latent sarcasm. They were the first people, Terry, I'd ever heard use words for meanings that weren't apparent. For example, this guitar player, Ron McClure, I recall from those days, used to say beautiful man when he meant its opposite, and that had a deep impression, made a very deep impression on my head.
You think it affected the way you ended up talking?
Yes, I think so. I mean, certainly my way of thinking is very ripe by this point, and I think that I was started on that slippery slope by those guys around Pittsburgh.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a short break, and
then we'll
come back for some more music with Joel Forrester. Joel Forrester is a pianist, composer, and co-founder of the group, the Microscopic Septet. This is Fresh Air. Back with Joel Forrester at the piano. Joel, you want to play another piece for us?
Okay.
What's that piece called?
It's called Lunacy, Terry.
When did you write it?
Now that's in that post-jail time, San Francisco, 71, I guess.
What were you going through musically at the time, or
God
emotionally?
Knows. You know, I mean, I think R. Crumb was correct when he said that if you remember the 60s, you weren't there. Now, I have no idea what I was going through.
Okay, that's a terrific piece. I really love it.
Well, you know, I usually improvise on it, too, but you wanted the short version.
Yeah, that's right.
You know?
Yeah. All right. Okay. Some of the work you're doing in New York now has to do with trying to revitalize the musicians' union and make it relevant to jazz musicians. I think it's fair to say that in New York, the musicians' union has mostly been for people in theatrical settings.
Yes, that's right.
And also for catered affairs. You know, mm-hmm. where you're playing with a pickup band or something, and there's, you know, the musician kind of regulates what the union regulates what the standard fee is going to be for weddings and bar mitzvahs and things like that.
Yes, that's right, Terry. Luckily for those of us who spend most of our time improvising music, just in the last few years, there have been a couple ears in the musicians' union, ears that have appreciated our kind of music and understand the importance of keeping it alive. In fact, the current administration in the city of New York has been sympathetic to musicians who play real music in clubs.
What's an example of how you can make the musicians' union more relevant to jazz musicians?
Well, the example that springs into my mind is has to do with a club that fired its entire group of musicians several years ago because they attempted to bargain collectively. We found out through the musicians' union this was actually illegal by state labor standards. And using the legal force of the union, really as advisors, we decided not to recognize the firing since it was illegal. And we had a job action that we actually called a strike. It only lasted 3 weeks, and the club succumbed because they weren't used to dealing with people collectively. And we succeeded in getting a real contract. That's important because, again, this is something that people not in New York should know. The club scene is difficult in New York only because the club owners really have the upper hand. Anything that what's good about the club scene in New York is that there's no one kind of music there. And so oddballs like myself can play there because club owners don't have a clue about what music is standard or normative or popular. That's good. But as individuals, club owners can really lord it over musicians. That's why I think it's important that musicians stand together. And that also reflects, I think, a greater thing that's happening, which is just more openness among jazz musicians, less competition, an attempt to share information about gigs. And I think what's really behind that is more musical, I think, even than labor-oriented. I think musicians want our music to change, and we're all interested in a sort of a repollination of the music. We want it to keep going. We want it to turn into whatever it's going to turn into next. And so we're sharing a lot of information, musical information.
We are unfortunately running out of time. Let me ask you to play something to close us out.
Oh, God, I'd love to. Actually, what I have in mind to play is a tune that I wrote for one of my fellow two-fisted pianists, Joe Ruddock. Pictures him, if you will, as a matador, and it's called In the Ring. Thank you.
great. Joel Forrester has been playing for us. And Joel, do you have any solo records you plan on making?
Oh, plans. I guess eventually.
Goals, Joel. What are your goals?
It's all in the moment, Terry. No, I just want to keep on writing music. I think maybe this summer I'll be playing solo at the Montreal Jazz Festival, though.
Great. Well, I thank you so much. It's really been just wonderful to hear you play. Thanks so much for coming to Fresh Air.
Oh, it's been wonderful to be here.
Joel Forrester is pianist, composer, co-founder of the Microscopic Septet, and they do have several records out. Joel, can you play us out?
I'd love to.
Joel Forrester, as recorded in concert last May. Joel composed the new Fresh Air theme. It's performed by the Microscopic Septet, a band Joel co-founded. Their latest record is Beauty Based on Science. Actually, Joel wrote a lot more for us than the theme, and you'll be hearing more of his music in the days to come on Fresh Air. If you'd like to hear him in person, he performs in Manhattan Friday and Saturday nights at the lounge on the fifth floor of the Embassy Suites Hotel on 47th and 7th Avenue. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. In the movie Good Morning Vietnam, actor Bruno Kirby played a self-righteous lieutenant. In When Harry Met Sally, he was Billy Crystal's best friend. And in the comedy The Freshman, he was the nephew of the Godfather, played by Marlon Brando, of course. Coming up, a talk with Bruno Kirby. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the soundtrack of the film Tune In Tomorrow, with music composed and performed by Wynton Marsalis. And a vampire is back among the living in a soap opera that has returned to life. TV critic David Bianculli reviews the return of Dark Shadows. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Geneva, after over 6 hours of talk, Secretary of State Baker told a packed hall of reporters that there had been no signs of Iraqi flexibility. And he warned if Iraq does not pull out of Kuwait by a January 15th deadline, there will be a military confrontation. NPR's Ann Garrels has more.
Secretary of State Baker said while there's no reason for either he or President Bush to meet the Iraqis again, he suggested the UN Secretary General might play a helpful role in the days ahead. Baker insisted he's still hoping for a peaceful solution. But as a precaution, Baker said he had asked for and received Iraqi assurances that the remaining American diplomatic personnel in Baghdad can leave on January 12th. Iraqi Foreign Minister Tariq Aziz insisted Iraq would defend itself boldly in a war, and when asked by a reporter if Iraq would attack Israel, he answered, absolutely yes. While Baker focused on the invasion of Kuwait, Tariq Aziz never mentioned it in his press conference, focusing instead on the Palestinian issue, accusing the U.S. of double standards in the region. Aziz defended what he merely called the actions of August 2nd, saying Iraq was under threat, a claim Baker said he could not believe. I'm Ann Garrels in Geneva.
According to U.N. officials in New York City, Secretary General Perez de Cuellar will leave for Iraq tomorrow in a last-minute effort to prevent war in the Persian Gulf. The Secretary General has been urged to make a final effort for peace after talks in Geneva failed to make a breakthrough. In Washington, President Bush said this afternoon he is discouraged and disappointed with the failure of talks between Secretary of State James Baker and Iraqi Foreign Minister Tariq Aziz. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Mr. Bush says the Iraqi foreign minister gave the U.S. a total stiff arm and that Tariq Aziz's presentation of today's talks indicated the Iraqis are trying to avoid the key issue in the Persian Gulf crisis, the annexation of Kuwait. He says he won't allow the Iraqis to link the Palestinian question with Iraq's withdrawal from Kuwait.
I listened to that Aziz meeting, and all he tried to do is obfuscate, to confuse, to make everybody think this had to do with the West Bank, for example. And it doesn't. It has to do with the aggression against Kuwait.
However, Mr. Bush says he still hopes a diplomatic solution to the Gulf crisis can be found. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the White House.
A crowd estimated at some 1,500 gathered on the campus of Ohio State University in Columbus today in a protest against the possibility of war in the Persian Gulf. Students from at least 40 colleges, along with others, attended the rally, organized by several peace groups. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 39 points to close at 2,470.30, volume some 191 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says that jazz fans can be divided into two groups, the ones who think trumpeter Wynton Marsalis is the greatest thing to happen to jazz in 30 years, and the ones who don't. Kevin says he's not that impressed, not most of the time anyway.
Those of us who aren't crazy about Wynton Marsalis are often exasperated by his excessive deference to the past. Jazz is like a shark. It has to keep moving in order to survive. But Marsalis's highly polished stuff doesn't take the music anywhere new. His latest album, the soundtrack to the movie Tune In Tomorrow, is, as usual, meticulously crafted and backward-looking, but it's different from his other records, and I like it a lot. If you know Duke Ellington's music, this is going to sound really familiar. This is the best counterfeit Ellington I've ever heard. It's so accurate it made me laugh out loud the first time I put it on. It works because Marsalis knows a convincing forgery depends on attention to detail. As everyone always points out, Ellington wrote for the specific players in his band, so Marsalis has written character parts for his own musicians. Clarinetist Alvin Batiste impersonates Jimmy Hamilton. Herman Riley does drummer Sam Woodyard's rim shots. And Marsalis recreates Cootie Williams' wah-wah trumpet. It's a shtick, but it's not easy to pull off. Tune In Tomorrow deals with radio actors in the 1950s, so this soundtrack makes conceptual sense. The musicians act out their roles in a carefully recreated period setting. It also makes sense because the film is set in New Orleans. Ellington's reliance on distinct lead voices echoes New Orleans jazz in the first place. There are other reasons why this music makes sense. A lot of jazz musicians who came up after Marcellus are long on technique but short on originality, so projects like this are perfect for their skills. And if young musicians have to dwell in the past, Marcellus is smart to point them towards Ellington. Duke was so far ahead of his time, with his advanced sense of form, his imaginative voicings, and rich dissonant harmony. There's nothing archaic about his music. Listening to his amazing trumpet section has made Marcellus a more expressive player, too. And even when Winton doesn't attempt to write just like Ellington, the master's ideas seep in anyway. As a composer, Marcellus uses Duke's example, the way he once used Miles Davis's style as a trumpet player, as a springboard to finding his own voice. Like most soundtrack albums, the one for Tune In Tomorrow contains some odds and ends that don't fit with the central concept. There are vocals by jazz singer Shirley Horn and soul singer Johnny Adams, and a little straight New Orleans jazz. That music is good too, but the Ellingtonian stuff really makes the album exceptional. By a few standards, it's the best music Marcellus has recorded yet.
Kevin Whitehead reviewed Winton Marcellus' soundtrack from Tune In Tomorrow. From it, here's a song with Johnny Adams.
Let me tell you something that's true. Do this to me, and it's the fact it's true. It might be back to fiction, but it's my point of view.
This is Fresh Air. The success of Godfather 3 is leading a lot of moviegoers back to Godfathers 1 and 2 at the video store. Just out on video is The Freshman, in which Marlon Brando does a comic turn on his character of Don Corleone. In The Freshman, Brando plays Carmine Sabatini. My guest Bruno Kirby is his nephew Vic. You might remember Kirby from Good Morning Vietnam as the humorless officer who was always offering Robin Williams advice on how to be funny. He also played Billy Crystal's best friend in When Harry Met Sally. The title character in The Freshman is played by Matthew Broderick. As the movie opens, Broderick is leaving his Vermont home to study film at NYU. When he arrives at Grand Central Station, he falls for a cheap scam. Bruno Kirby offers to drive him to NYU for $10 and drives off with Broderick's luggage and money. A few days later, Broderick sees Kirby on the street, chases after him, and demands to be given his money back.
If you don't give me the money, like, immediately...
Clark, I would love nothing more than to be able to do just that. However, here we run into an awkward moment. Tragically, I suffer from a gambling problem. Right after I left you, I placed a wager on a horse. Predictably.
You lost me money and a horse. All of it.
In retrospect, I'm not sure it actually was a horse.
Oh, God.
When you were preparing to play Vic, did you walk around New York a lot looking for scam artists?
The first thing I did was, when I was doing Tin Men with Danny DeVito, he introduced me to a great guy named Cha-Cha. And Cha-Cha became a friend, and he has a little Italian cafe on Mulberry Street called Cha-Cha's in Boca Lupo Cafe. And the minute I got this part, I called up Cha-Cha, and I said, look, here's what I need. Can I come down there with you guys? Can I hang out with you and your friends? Can I see a little bit about what that life down there is like? And Cha-Cha said, sure, come on, forget about it, anything for you. When I went down there, and Cha-Cha isn't a scam artist by any means, but he was able to let me see, you know, he took me where they bought their clothes, he showed me where their loyalty was, he showed me the Chinese restaurants they like to eat at 2 o'clock in the morning, where they like to go gambling. And he was a very big help, and without him and his friend Butchie, then I could have never done it. In terms of scam artists and things like that, I never look for the negatives in my character. I can't play negatives. I don't think people in life, when they get up in the morning, you know, have negative ideas. And I think what Vic says every morning when he gets up is, what can I do today to please the person in the world who I respect and love the most, my Uncle Carmine? What can I do to win his love and respect?
Marlon Brando plays an organized crime head, and everybody comments on his remarkable resemblance to the Godfather in the movie, and there's a lot of Godfather jokes in this movie. Now, you were in Godfather 2, right?
Yeah.
Now, I have to confess to you, I don't remember your part in it. And
well, that's okay. That's a compliment.
Because I wouldn't recognize you in it?
I gained 60 pounds. I had my hairline shaved back. I spoke all Sicilian. I played Clemenza as a young man. When De Niro comes to America, I take him to steal a rug, and I introduce him to a life of crime. I don't mind that you don't recognize me. To someone who likes to play different characters, that's a good thing.
How come you gained 60 pounds for it?
Well, the character of Clemenza is a very heavy character later on in the film. So I knew that we had to show that stuff starting to happen even in his youth.
See, I've always thought of you as the kind of actor who maybe grows a mustache for a role, you know, but who doesn't, not the kind of actor who puts on 60 pounds for a role.
Well, I do whatever is necessary. I mean, yeah. If you see The Freshman, that's not my hairline. That bald spot isn't mine.
Mm-hmm.
That receding hairline isn't mine. That's stuff I found from hanging out in Little Italy. You know, the character in When Harry Met Sally has a fat pad on at the beginning of the film. People don't even see it. But after he marries Carrie Fisher and she changes his life for the better, I took off the fat pad to show some kind of a, you know, she's made him a better person. She's got him exercising. He's not just sitting around bars at night drinking with the guys. He's doing things.
The movie that I really first started tracking you in, where I first started saying, oh, watch this guy, was Good Morning Vietnam. I don't know why it took me that long, but you played the lieutenant who thinks that Robin Williams should really stick to the Mantovani playlist.
Yes.
Tell me more about what you did to make this character so funny, because I really thought that you were actually one of the funniest things in the movie.
Well, you see, you can't really play a result. So I think the humor... When I approach a character, whether it's a comedy or a drama, I just approach it from their point of view. Now, what makes it funny sometimes is if a person is so sincere about their point of view that they can only see their point of view. So I think that's what gave that character the humor.
Furthermore, you want to stick to playing normal modes of music, not wild stuff. Those we would find acceptable here would include Lawrence Welk, Jim Nabors, Mantovani.
Percy Faith.
Percy Faith, good! Thank you. Andy Williams, Perry Como, and certain ballads by Mr. Frank Sinatra.
Would Bob Dylan be out of line?
Way, way, way out of line.
You played it as someone who really believes that they're right and
totally.
Smart and talented.
Totally.
And they really don't get it at all. They have no idea.
They have no idea, and I don't believe that this character woke up every morning and said, today I'm going to be the biggest jerk the United States the United States Army ever produced. I think when he woke up every day and said, I have a great idea. These men are coming back from battle. Let me play soothing music for them.
Your father was an actor, right?
He still is. Great actor, Bruce Kirby.
What roles is he best known for?
Well, he was last seen, he was the head detective in Throw Mama from the Train. The first time around when Jamie Lee Curtis had her TV series, he played her dad. And we're very, very close. We were born the same day. When I was born, I think my father just said, well, my best friend has arrived. And even though I was a kid, he would take me every place with him. He took me to Lee Strasberg's classes and he'd say, sit down, just be quiet. He'd come home from work like 2 o'clock in the morning working as a waiter. He'd pick me up, he'd take me to 42nd Street, and we would watch Fellini films and Brando films. I was just a little kid, but we hung out together.
Did you like spending that much time with your father when you were young?
I loved it. It was sensational.
So did this get you excited about movies and about acting?
Well, you know what I think I saw? I looked at these actors, his friends, and I saw the camaraderie. I saw the stories, the way they would kid each other, put each other on. And I think I wanted to be part of it.
Was it helpful to have a father who was an actor, but not a father who was overwhelmingly famous, who you felt that you could never, ever live up to?
Well, I wouldn't know about the second part of it because, you know, I consider my dad to me knows more about acting than anybody I've ever met. He knows more about my acting than anyone. I mean, I remember when I was getting ready to do Good Morning Vietnam, I always give him my scripts and we always talk about my roles. I give him the Good Morning Vietnam script, and we're going to shoot the film in Bangkok. So I go by his house to say, you know, to go over the script a little bit, but basically to say goodbye. It's the day before I leave. And I'm kind of running, you know, that kind of place you get when you're thinking about a trip, and he's talking to me about the character, and I'm just shaking my head, yes, 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 yes. And he says, okay, goodbye. I say, goodbye, Dad, I love you. And I start to leave, and he goes, wait, Bruno, one more thing. I said, yeah, Dad, what is it? He said, you know, I think this is the kind of character who would send jokes to Reader's Digest. And I said, okay, take care, I love you, goodbye. And I find myself on the set with Barry Levinson, and I say, you know, Barry, I just want to say something here. I just want to say that, tell Robin that Reader's Digest is publishing two of my jokes. And Barry, because he's got his own kind of genius, says, okay, but they're just considering publishing two of your jokes.
Do you often do that, by the way, add things to a character?
Yeah, constantly.
What's an example of something you added in The Freshman?
In The Freshman? Wow, let's see. Oh, I know some stuff that we added. Marlon is so facile. He has this thing where he starts, when the kid sits down, he says, you want a nut? And the kid says, no. I say, none for me, Uncle Carmine. And he says, you want some coffee to the kid? I say, none for me, Uncle Carmine. Well, that stuff, that part of the relationship wasn't scripted. In other words, we didn't know Marlon was going to offer him a nut, but I just instinctively knew that if I acted as if he was offering something to me too, that Marlon would totally ignore me, and it would give the character a different kind of shading. And that's one of the things that just kind of happened as we were shooting.
Do you have one of your earlier films that you wish were better known now, because you really liked your performance in it?
I liked my performance in a film called Texas Legend, but they changed the title to Kiss My Grits. They did this to see if they could get me to kill myself, but it was one of the most painful experiences I've ever had in my life. I did this movie. It was produced by Tony Quinn. It was Bruce Davison was in the movie. He did a wonderful job. And I played a sheep herder from Texas. So I went down to Texas, and I worked on a sheep ranch. And he was just a good old boy, and he fell in love with this girl who didn't really care about him at all. And I thought I did a lot of wonderful work. But the company who released the film ended up doing a drawing in Variety of Bruce Davison and myself with our pants dropped, looking over our shoulders, saying, kiss our grits. And the film was one of those films that shows up at about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. And I'm sorry that I wasn't able to do, you know, that character someplace else where more people might have seen him. But otherwise, I don't have too many regrets.
Another question about The Freshman. When you were playing scenes with Brando, did it take a while before you stopped feeling intimidated? Did you feel intimidated
at
all?
No, not at all. He takes that right away from you. The first time I met him, I was waiting for him to come to rehearsal at Andy Bergman's. And we're waiting. Matthew's getting a little edgy. Penelope Ann Miller's getting a little edgy because you're meeting Marlon Brando. You can't deny that. And he walks in and he looks at me and he says, you know, the last time I saw you, you had on a brown derby and a long coat and you were stealing a rug. Come here. And he gives me this hug. And basically what he's doing is he's absorbing all of my tension into himself. And 5 minutes later, you turn around and you're sitting around this table and you're working with somebody who I think is as good as it gets, and you're totally relaxed because of him.
I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Oh, thank you. This has been a lot of fun.
Actor Bruno Kirby on Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah, what will you have on the meeting between James Baker and Tariq Aziz?
Practically the entire program this evening, Terry. There was a six-hour meeting, as you know, in Geneva. And afterwards, Mr. Baker came out and said, I heard nothing today that suggested to me any Iraqi flexibility. In Iraq, Saddam Hussein said that if war starts, Americans will be swimming in their own blood. Secretary of Defense Dick Cheney is said now to be recommending an activation of 1 million more military reserves. And Secretary of State Baker, again after the meeting, said all the U.S. diplomats in Iraq will be leaving that country by Saturday.
Thanks, Noah. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Back in the 60s, the horror soap opera Dark Shadows had a loyal cult following. That cult continued into the 90s by way of home video. Dark Shadows returns to the airwaves this weekend on NBC. TV critic David Bianculli is prepared with a crucifix, cloves of garlic, and a steak and hammer.
Available now on MPI Home Video.
What are you doing here?
Get ready to scream again, because Dark Shadows is back.
That's worth screaming about, all right. I never could understand the appeal of Dark Shadows. Not because the show was a soap opera about vampires and witches, but because the only scary thing about it was how awful the acting and writing were. Jonathan Frid, who played vampire Barnabas Collins, was the worst. Unfortunately, he was also the star, even though he could never seem to recite a line of dialogue without flubbing it or stopping in mid-sentence to remember the rest. Here's a typical scene from that series, with Frid confiding in Dr. Julia Hoffman, who's played by Grayson Hall.
I don't know why you want to continue with these injections. Obviously, they aren't working.
Don't be so pessimistic, Barnabas.
But we must get on with the experiment now.
You know we can't do that.
Julia, we have less than 48 hours before that lifeless creature upstairs becomes useless and I have to revert back to what I was.
Oh, Barnabas, I'm doing all I can to help you. That's all I can do.
The original Dark Shadows, like a vampire, bites and sucks. Also like a vampire, it's coming back from the dead. Mainly because the creator of Dark Shadows, Dan Curtis, went on to bigger and better things, like making War and Remembrance, so now he has the clout to do what he wants. I won't be nasty and point out that Curtis could hardly have gone on to smaller and worse things after the original Dark Shadows. But in remaking Dark Shadows, Curtis has done two things he didn't do the first time around. Spend money on special effects and hire a few good actors. This Barnabas, for example, is played by Ben Cross, the lonely long-distance runner in Chariots of Fire. And this time around, Dr. Julia is played by Barbara Steele, who produced War and Remembrance with Curtis. It's a nice casting touch because around the time when the old Dark Shadows was on the air, Steele was starring in a series of Italian horror films. Needless to say, they both come off well in comparison to the originals.
What would you say if I told you I could give you a normal life?
Doctor, the curse of my existence is beyond the realm of your science.
You would like to lead a normal life, wouldn't you?
Do you really believe that anyone could actually enjoy an existence such as mine? I haven't seen the light of day nor felt the warmth of the sun for 200 years.
There's a lot more dry ice this time around, and the cast members, especially the women, are a lot sexier. But the new scripts are nearly as bad as the old ones, and neither the horror nor the humor is in quite the right vein, so to speak. For a while, I guess I'll keep watching the new Dark Shadows as a guilty pleasure. But based on the way it's starting out, there'll be a lot more guilt than pleasure.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post. Our reviews are produced by Naomi Person, with production assistance from Joan Tuohy, Roberta Shurrock, and Sue Spolin. Our new theme music is composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a history lesson on how the map of the Middle East was redrawn by the Americans and the Europeans after World War I. Also, we talk with Middle East historian Rashid Khalidi. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.